to be noticed and hid them between the pages of Dombey and Son. An Estonian woman noticed me drawing and gave me additional paper. We hauled logs, but only for our nightly bonfires. We sat around the crackling fires and sang Lithuanian songs. The entire forest echoed in song from the people of the Baltic singing of their homeland. Two women were chosen to travel to Chirimkov by train and help carry supplies back for the NKVD. They mailed our letters for us. "Please, could you take this to Chirimkov and pass it along to someone?" I handed a slat of wood to the woman. "It's lovely. The flowers. You've done a beautiful job. I had rue flowers in my backyard at home," she said, sighing. She looked up at me. "Your father is in Krasnoyarsk?" I nodded. "Lina, please don't get your hopes up. Krasnoyarsk is a long way from here," said Mother. One day, after sitting in the sun, Mother and I waded into the Angara. We ran out of the water laughing. Our clothes clung tightly to our thin bodies. "Cover yourself," said Jonas, looking around. "What do you mean?" said Mother, pulling at the wet fabric clinging to her. "They're watching," said Jonas, motioning with his head to the NKVD. "Jonas, they have no interest. Look at us. We're hardly glamorous," said Mother, wringing water from her hair. I wrapped my arms around my torso. "They found Mrs. Arvidas interesting. Maybe he finds you interesting," said Jonas. Mother's hands dropped. "What are you talking of?"
"Who?"
"Nikolai," said Jonas.
"Kretzky?" I said.
"What about him?"
"Ask Mother," said Jonas.
"Stop it, Jonas. We don't know Nikolai," said Mother. I faced Mother. "Why do you call him Nikolai? How do you know his name?" Mother looked from me to Jonas.
"I asked him his name," she said.
My stomach dropped. Was Jonas right?
"But Mother, he's a monster,"
I said, wiping water from the scar on my forehead. She moved in closer, wringing out her skirt.
"We don't know what he is,"
I snorted.
"He's a..."
Mother grabbed me by the arm. Pain shot up into my shoulder. She spoke through clenched teeth.
"We don't know. Do you hear me? We don't know what he is. He's a boy. He's just a boy."
Mother let go of my arm.
"And I'm not lying with him," she spat at Jonas. "How dare you imply such a thing?"
"Mother," stammered Jonas. She walked away, leaving me rubbing my arm. Jonas stood, shocked by Mother's outburst. Chapter 67. For weeks, the barges crept farther north up on the Angara. We disembarked and rode for days in the back of black trucks through dense forests. We passed enormous fallen trees with trunks so large the truck could have driven inside them. I saw no human beings. The dark forest seemed to surround us, impenetrable. Where were they taking us? We broiled each day and shivered at night. Blisters healed. We ate everything given to us, thankful we weren't put to work. The trucks arrived at Ustkut, on the river Lena. We waited once again for barges. The bank of the Lena was blanketed with tiny pebbles. It poured rain. The makeshift tents on the bank did nothing to shelter us. I lay on top of my suitcase, protecting Dombey and Son, the stone, my drawings, and our family photo. Janina stood in the rain. She stared at the sky, carrying on conversations with no one. Kretzky's boots crunched up and down the bank. He yelled at us to stay in groups. At night, he'd stand staring at the silvery ribbon of moonlight on the Lena, moving only to bring his glowing cigarette to his lips. My Russian improved. Jonas was still far ahead of me. After 2 weeks, the barges arrived and the NKVD once again boarded us to float north. We left Ustkut and passed Kerensk.
"We're traveling north," said Jonas. "Maybe we really will sail for America."
"And leave Papa behind?" I asked. Jonas looked out at the water. He said nothing. The repeater spoke of nothing but America. He tried to draw maps of the United States, discussing details he had heard from friends or relatives. He needed to believe it was possible. In America, there are excellent universities in an area they call New England. They say New York is quite fashionable, said Joanna. Who says New York is fashionable? I asked. My parents. What do they know of America? I asked. Mother has an uncle there, said Joanna. I thought all of Auntie's family was in Germany, I said. Apparently, she has a relative in America. She gets letters from him. He's in Pennsylvania. I don't care much for America. They certainly lack for art. I can't name a single American artist who is accomplished. You better not be drawing me, said the bald man. I don't want any pictures drawn of me. Actually, I'm almost finished, I said, shading in the gray area of his spotted cheeks. Tear it up, he insisted. No, I said. Don't worry, I won't show it to anyone. You won't if you know it's good for you. I looked down at my drawing. I had captured his curled lip and the surly expression he always wore. He wasn't ugly. The deep lines above his brow just made him look cranky. Why were you deported? I asked him. You said you were a stamp collector. But why would they deport you for collecting stamps? Mind your own business, he said. Where is your family? I pressed. I said it's none of your business, he snapped, pointing his crooked finger at me. And if you know what's best for you, you'll keep your drawings out of sight. You hear me? Yanina sat down next to me. You'll never be a famous artist, said the bald man.
Yes, she will, argued Yanina.
No, she won't. You know why? Because she's not dead. But maybe there's still hope for that. America! Bah! I stared at him.
My dolly's dead, said Yanina.
Chapter 68. We approached Yakutsk. Now we shall see. We shall see, said the repeater, fidgeting. If we disembark here, we will not go to America. We will not go.
Where would we go? Asked Jonas.
To the Kolyma region, said the bald man. To the prisons? Maybe Magadan?
We're not going to Magadan, said Mother.
Stop such talk, Mr. Stalas.
Not Kolyma. No. Not Kolyma, said the repeater.
The barges slowed.
No, please no, whispered Jonas.
We were coming to a stop. Mrs. Rimmis began to cry.
I can't be in prison this far from my husband.
Yanina tugged at my sleeve.
Liala says we're not going to Kolyma.
What? I said.
She says we're not going,
she shrugged. We crowded near the edge of the barge. Some of the NKVD disembarked. Kretzky was among them. He carried a rucksack. A commander met the guards on the shore. We watched as they checked assignments.
Look, said Jonas. Some of the NKVD are loading supplies onto the boat.
So we're not getting off here? I asked. Suddenly voices rose from the bank. It was Kretzky. He was arguing with a commander. I understood the commander. He told Kretzky to get back on the barge.
Kretzky wants to stay, said Jonas.
Good. Let him stay, I said. Kretzky flailed his arms at the commander, who pointed back at the boat. Mother sighed and looked down. Kretzky turned back toward the barge. He wasn't leaving. He was coming with us, wherever we were going. The passengers cheered and embraced as the barge pulled away from Yakutsk. A week later, spirits were still buoyant. People sang on the deck of the barge. Someone played an accordion. Kretzky stormed through the crowd, shoving people aside.
What's wrong with you? Are you all imbeciles? You cheer as if you're going to America. Fools, he yelled.
The elation collapsed to murmurs.
America. America?
said the repeater quietly. Where were they taking us? It was already August. Temperatures dropped as we sailed northward. It felt like late October, not summer. The forests along the bank of the Lena thinned.
We've crossed into the Arctic Circle, announced the man who wound his watch.
What? Gasped Jonas. How can that be? Where are they taking us?
That is correct, said the repeater. We'll go to the mouth of the Lena and get on huge steamships to America. Steamships.
The barges stopped in Bulun and stole by in the Arctic. We watched as large groups were herded off the barge and simply left standing on the deserted shore as we pulled away. We sailed on. In late August, we reached the mouth of the River Lena. The temperature was just above freezing. The icy waves of the Laptev Sea crashed against the barge as it was moored to the shore.
Davai!
Yelled the guards, jabbing us with the butts of their rifles.
They're going to drown us, said the bald man. They've brought us all this way to drown us and get rid of us here.
Dear God, no, said Mrs. Rimmis. The NKVD threw a wooden plank against the side of the barge. They pushed the children down the plank, screaming for them to hurry.
Hurry? Where? There's nothing here, said Mother.
She was right. It was completely uninhabited. Not a single bush or tree. Just barren dirt to a shore of endless water. We were surrounded by nothing but polar tundra and the Laptev Sea. The wind whipped. Sand blew into my mouth and stung my eyes. I clutched my suitcase and looked around. The NKVD made their way to two brick buildings near a cluster of trees. How would we all fit? There were more than 300 of us. Kretzky argued with some of the NKVD, repeating that he had to go to Yakutsk. An NKVD with greasy hair and brown crooked teeth stopped us.
Where do you think you're going? He demanded.
To the buildings, said Mother.
Those are for the officers, he snapped.
And where are we supposed to stay? Asked Mother. Where is the village? The guard waved his arms wide.
This is the village. You have the whole village for yourself.
The other NKVD laughed. Excuse me? Said Mother.
What? You don't like it? You think you're too good for this? Fascist pig! Pigs sleep in the mud! Didn't you know that? But before you sleep, you'll have to finish the bakery and build a fish factory.
He moved closer to Mother. His corroded teeth protruded from under his top lip.
You fascists like fish, don't you? You pigs disgust me.
He spit on her chest and walked away.
You don't even deserve the mud, he yelled over his shoulder.
They made us carry bricks and wood from the barge. We filed in and out of the barge's deep hold, carrying as many bricks as we could. It took 10 hours to unload the barges. In addition to bricks and wood, we carried barrels of kerosene, flour, and even small fishing boats, all for the NKVD. My arms trembled with fatigue.
Liala says we're not going to America, announced Yanina.
No kidding. Did your ghost doll tell you we'd be here? Demanded the bald man.
He pointed to a sign crisped and faded from the weather. Trofimovsk, the very top of the Arctic Circle, near the North Pole. Chapter 69. We huddled together and pulled our coats tight for warmth. I longed for the labor camp, for Ilyushka's hut, for Andrus. The steamer's whistle shrieked and pulled the barges back down the Lena. Were they going to pick up more people?
How will you mail letters to Papa from here? Asked Jonas.
There has to be a village close by, said Mother. I thought of the piece of wood handed off in Chiromkov. Something had to have made its way to Papa by now.
So this is their plan, said the bald man looking around. This is how Stalin will end us. He'll let us freeze to death. He'll let the foxes eat us.
Foxes, said Mrs. Rimmis. Yanina's mother snapped a glance at the bald man.
If there are foxes, we can eat them, said Jonas.
Have you ever caught a fox, boy? Asked the bald man.
No, but I'm sure it can be done, said Jonas.
He said we have to build a factory for them, I said.
This can't be our destination, said Mother.
Surely they're going to transport us somewhere else.
Don't be so sure, Elena, said the man who wound his watch. To the Soviets, there is no more Lithuania, Latvia, or Estonia. Stalin must completely get rid of us to see his vision unlittered.
Litter? Is that what we were to Stalin?
It's nearly September, said the man who wound his watch. Soon the polar night will be upon us.
Nearly September. We were freezing. We had learned about the polar night in school. In the polar region, the sun falls below the horizon for 180 days. Darkness for nearly half a year. I hadn't paid much attention to the lecture in school. I had sketched the sun sinking over the horizon. Now my heart sank into my stomach where the bile began to chew it.
We haven't much time, continued the man who wound his watch. I think...
Stop it! Stop talking! Shrieked Yanina's mother. What's wrong, dear? Asked Mother.
Shh! Don't draw the attention of the guards, said Mrs. Rimmis.
Mama, what's wrong?
Asked Yanina. Her mother continued shrieking. The woman had barely spoken during the entire voyage, and suddenly we couldn't make her stop.
I can't do this! I won't die here! I will not let a fox eat us!
Suddenly, the woman grabbed Yanina by the throat. A thick gurgle came from Yanina's windpipe. Mother threw herself on Yanina's mother and pried her fingers from her daughter's neck. Yanina caught her breath and began to sob.
I'm so sorry, cried her mother.
She turned her back to us, placed her hands on her own throat, and tried to strangle herself. Mrs. Rimmis slapped the woman across the face. The man who wound his watch restrained her arms.
What's wrong with you? If you want to kill yourself, do it in private, said the bald man.
It's your fault, I said. You told her she'd be eaten by a fox.
Stop it, Lina, said Jonas.
Mama,
sobbed Yanina.
She already talks to her dead doll. Do we really want to hear about her dead mother? Said the bald man.
Mama!
Shrieked Yanina.
You're going to be fine, said Mother, stroking the woman's filthy hair. We're all going to be fine. We mustn't lose our senses. It's going to be all right, really.
Chapter 70. At daybreak, the NKVD shouted at us to get to work. My neck hurt from sleeping on my suitcase. Jonas and Mother had slept under a fishing boat to protect themselves from the wind. I had only slept a few hours. After everyone was asleep, I drew by moonlight. I sketched Yanina's mother, her hands squeezing tight around her daughter's neck, Yanina's eyes bulging. I wrote a letter to Andrus, telling him we were in Trofimovsk. How would I ever mail the letter? Would Andrus think I had forgotten about him?
I'll find you, he had said.
How could he ever find us here? Papa, I thought, you're coming for us. Hurry. The NKVD divided us into 25 groups, 15 people per group. We were group number 11. They took the men with any strength and sent them to work finishing the NKVD barracks. The boys were sent to fish in the Laptev Sea. The remainder of the women and elderly were instructed to build a yurta, a hut, for their group. We could not, however, use any of the bricks or wood near the NKVD building. Those were reserved for the NKVD barracks. After all, winter was coming and the NKVD needed warm housing, said Ivanov, the brown-toothed guard. We could use scraps or pieces of logs that might have floated ashore.
Before we even think of building something, we'll need supplies, said Mrs. Rimmis.
Hurry, scatter and pick up anything and everything you find before the others take it. Bring it back here. I picked up large stones, sticks, and chips of brick. Were we really going to build a house from sticks and stones? Mother and Mrs. Rimmis found logs that had washed ashore. They dragged them all the way back to our site and went back for more. I saw a woman digging up moss with her hands and using it as mortar between the rocks. Yanina and I ripped up pieces of moss and piled it near our supplies. My stomach churned with hunger. I couldn't wait for Jonas to return with the fish. He returned wet and shivering. His hands were empty. "Where are the fish?" I asked, my teeth chattering. "The guards say we're not allowed fish. All of the fish we catch is stored for the NKVD. "What will we eat?" I asked. "Bread rations," he replied. It took us a week to collect enough logs to create a framework for our yurta. The men discussed the design. I drew the sketches. "These logs don't look very strong," commented Jonas. "They're just driftwood."
"It's all we have," said the man who wound his watch. "We must hurry. We must finish before the first snow comes. If we don't, we won't survive." "Hurry! Hurry!" said the repeater.
I dug deep notches in the hard dirt with a flat stone. The ground was frozen. As I dug deeper, I had to hack at ice. Mother, Mrs. Rimmis, and I stood the logs vertically in the notches. We packed dirt around them. "It doesn't look big enough for 15 people," I said, looking at the framing. The wind whipped, stinging my face. "We'll be warmer if we're close together," said Mother. Ivanov approached with Kretsky. I understood most of their conversation.
"The slowest pigs in Trofimovsk," said Ivanov through his rotten teeth.
"You'll need a roof," said Kretsky, motioning with his cigarette. "Yes, I know. And heat," I said. We had enough logs for a roof, but what would we do for heat?
"We'll need a stove," Mother said in Russian.
Ivanov found that particularly funny.
"You'd like a stove? What else? A hot bath? A glass of cognac? Shut up and get to work."
He walked away. Mother looked at Kretsky. He looked down and then walked off. "See? He won't help," I said. We worked for another week building from scratch. It wasn't a house. It was a dung heap, a bunch of logs covered in mud, sand, and moss. It looked like something a child would make in the dirt, and we had to live in it. The men finished building the barracks and a bakery for the NKVD. They were proper brick buildings with stoves or fireplaces in each room. The man who wound his watch said it was well outfitted. And we were expected to endure an Arctic winter in a mud hut? No, they expected us not to endure at all. Chapter 71. The day after we finished our yurta, Yanina came running to me.
"Lena, there's a ship! There's a ship coming!"
Within seconds, the NKVD was upon us, pointing rifles in our faces. They ordered everyone into their yurtas. They ran, screaming, frantic.
"Jonas!" Mother yelled. "Lena, where is Jonas?"
"He was sent to fish," I said.
"Davai!"
barked Ivanov, pushing me into the yurta.
"Jonas!"
yelled Mother, stumbling to get away from Ivanov.
"He's coming, Elena," said Mr. Lucas, running toward us. "I saw him behind me."
Jonas arrived out of breath from running.
"Mother, there's a ship. It has an American flag."
"The Americans have arrived. They've arrived," said the repeater.
"Will the Americans fight the NKVD?"
asked Yanina.
"Stupid girl. The Americans are helping the NKVD," said the bald man.
"They're hiding us," said Mother. "The guards don't want the Americans to see us, to know what they're doing to us."
"Won't the Americans wonder what these mud huts are?" I asked.
"They'll think they're some sort of military unit," said the man who wound his watch.
"Should we run out so the Americans can see us?" I asked.
"They'll shoot you," said the bald man.
"Stay put, Lena,"
said Mother.
Do you understand me?
She was right. The NKVD was hiding us from the Americans. We stayed in our yurtas for more than 5 hours. That's how long it took for the American ship to be unloaded. As soon as the ship sailed, the NKVD came screaming for us to get to work. There were supplies to be moved to the bakery and NKVD barracks. I watched as the American ship drifted out of sight, pulling thoughts of rescue away with it. I wanted to run to the shore, waving my arms, screaming. The supplies were stacked on large wooden pallets and stone as tall and wide as 4 homes in Kaunas. Food. It was so close. Jonas told me to keep an eye on the wood from the pallet, that we could use it to build a door for our yurta. The man who wound his watch spoke English. He translated the markings on the containers. Canned peas, tomatoes, butter, condensed milk, powdered eggs, sugar, flour, vodka, whiskey. More than 300 Lithuanians and Finns moved mountains of food and supplies they would never again touch. How much food was there in America that a ship could drop such an enormous supply for fewer than 20 guards? And now the Americans had sailed away. Did they know the Soviets' gruesome secret? Were they turning the other cheek? After the food, we moved supplies. Kerosene, fishing nets, fur-lined coats, hats, thick leather gloves. The NKVD would be cozy for the winter. The wind blew through my threadbare coat. I strained to lift crate after crate with Jonas.
Please, stop, Mother told Mr. Lucas.
I'm sorry, he said, winding his watch. It calms me.
That's not what I meant. Stop translating the words on the crates. I can't bear to know what we're carrying anymore, Mother said as she walked away.
I want to know, objected the bald man. I want to know what might be available if the opportunity presents itself for one of you.
What does he mean? Asked Jonas.
Probably that he wants us to steal things for him, I said.
She's doing it again, said Jonas.
What? I asked. Jonas motioned to Mother. She was talking to Kretzky. Chapter 72. Jonas found an empty barrel floating in the Laptev Sea. He was able to pull it ashore with a log. He rolled it up to our yurta. The men cheered.
For a stove, Jonas said, smiling.
Good work, darling, said Mother. The men set to work on the barrel, using empty tin cans from the NKVD's trash to create a stovepipe. It was risky to carry or save your bread ration when Ivanov was around. He loved to take bread rations. 300 grams. That's all we got. Once I saw him snatch a piece of bread from an old woman in line at the bakery. He popped it into his mouth and chewed it up. She watched, her empty mouth chewing along with his. He spit it on her feet. She scrambled to pick up every chewed piece and eat it. Mrs. Rimmis said she heard Ivanov had been reassigned from a prison in Krasnoyarsk. The assignment in Trofimovsk had to be a demotion. Had Kretzky also been demoted? I wondered if Ivanov had been at the same prison as Papa. My stomach burned. I longed for the gray porridge they gave us on the train. I drew detailed pictures of food, steaming chicken with crispy glazed skin, bowls of plums, apple cakes with crumbling crusts. I wrote down the details of the American ship and the food it carried. The NKVD set us to rolling logs out of the Laptev Sea. We were to chop them up to dry for firewood. We weren't allowed any wood for ourselves. We sat in our yurta facing the empty stove. I saw plates with food being taken from our dinner table and pieces scraped into the trash. I heard Jonas's voice saying,
"But Mother, I'm not hungry,"
when told to finish his dinner. Not hungry? When were we ever not hungry?
"I'm cold," said Yanina.
"We'll go find some wood for the stove then," said the bald man.
"Where can I find it?" she asked.
"You can steal it.
near the NKVD building, he replied. That's where the others are getting it.
Don't send her to steal. I'll go find something, I said.
I'll come with you, said Jonas.
Mother? I expected her to protest.
Hmm?
She said. Jonas and I are going to look for wood.
All right, dear,
she said softly. Is Mother okay? I asked Jonas as we walked out of our mud hut.
She seems weaker and confused, said Jonas.
I stopped.
Jonas, have you seen Mother eat?
I think so, he said. Think about it. We've seen her nibble, but she's always giving us bread, I said. Just yesterday she gave us bread. She said it was an additional ration she got for hauling logs.
Do you think she's giving us her ration?
Yes, or at least part of it, I said. Mother was starving herself to feed us. The wind howled as we walked toward the NKVD building. My throat burned with each breath. The sun did not appear. The polar night had begun. The desolate landscape was painted in blues and grays by the moon. The repeater kept saying we had to make it through the first winter. Mother agreed. If we could make it through the first winter, we'd survive. We had to endure the polar night and see the sun return.
Are you cold? Asked Jonas.
Freezing. The wind sliced through my clothing and stabbed at my skin.
Do you want my coat? He asked. I think it will fit.
I looked at my brother. The coat Mother had traded was too big for him. He'd grow into it.
No, then you'll be cold, I said. But thanks.
Vilkas!
Kretzky. He wore a long wool coat and carried a canvas sack.
What are you doing? He demanded.
Looking for driftwood to burn, said Jonas. Have you seen any?
Kretzky hesitated. He reached into the bag and threw a piece of wood at our shins, walking away before we could say anything. That night, September 26, the first snowstorm arrived. It lasted 2 days. The wind and snow bellowed and blew through the cracks in our yurta. The freezing temperatures crept into my knees and hips. They ached and throbbed, making it hard to move. We huddled together for warmth. The repeater pushed in close. His breath smelled rotten.
Did you eat fish? Asked the bald man.
Fish? Yes. A little fish? Said the man.
Why didn't you bring any for us?
Demanded the bald man. Others also yelled at the repeater, calling him selfish.
I stole it. There was just a little. Only a little.
Viola doesn't like fish, whispered Yanina.
I looked at her. She clawed her scalp.
Does it itch? I asked.
She nodded. Lice. It was only a matter of time before our entire mud hut was crawling with them. We took turns digging a path out the front door to make our way to the bakery for rations. I scooped up large amounts of snow to melt for drinking water. Jonas made sure Mother ate her entire ration and drank water. We had been relieving ourselves outside, but with the snowstorm in full rage, we had no choice but to sit on a bucket in the yurta. As a courtesy, the sitter did not face us, but some argued the rear view was worse. Chapter 73. When the storm broke, the NKVD yelled at us to get back to work. We emerged from our mud hut. Even though it was dark, the white snow brightened the charcoal landscape. But that's all we could see. Gray everywhere. The NKVD ordered us to roll and chop logs for firewood. Jonas and I passed a yurta completely covered in snow.
No!
Cried a woman outside. The tips of her fingers were bloody, her fingernails shredded.
Idiots! They built their door so it opened out. When it snowed, they trapped themselves inside. The weaklings couldn't pull or claw the door down,
Ivanov laughed, slapping his thigh.
Four of them are dead in there. Stupid pigs, he said to another guard.
Jonas's mouth hung open.
What are you looking at? Yelled Ivanov.
Get to work!
I pulled Jonas away from the crying woman in the snow-covered mound.
He was laughing. Those people died and Ivanov was laughing, I said.
4 people died in the very first snowstorm, said Jonas, looking at his feet.
Maybe more. We need more wood. We have to make it through the winter.
They split us into groups. I had to walk 3 kilometers to the tree line to find wood for the NKVD. The bald man was in my group. We trudged through the snow, a dry crunching underfoot.
How am I expected to walk in this with my bad leg? Complained the bald man.
I tried to rush ahead. I didn't want to be stuck with him. He would slow me down.
Don't you leave me, he said. Give me your mittens.
What?
Give me your mittens. I don't have any.
No, my hands will freeze, I said, the cold already scraping against my face.
My hands are already freezing. Give me your mittens. It's only for a few minutes. You can put your hands in your pockets.
I thought about my brother offering me his coat and wondered if I should share my mittens with the bald man.
Give me your mittens and I'll tell you something, he said.
What are you going to tell me? I asked, suspicious.
Something you want to know?
What would I want to know from you? I asked.
Hurry, give me your mittens.
His teeth chattered. I walked on silent.
Just give me your damn mittens and I'll tell you why you were deported.
I stopped and stared at him. He snatched the mittens off my hands.
Well, don't just stand there. Keep walking or we'll freeze to death. Put your hands in your pockets.
We walked.
So? You know Patrice Vilkis?
He asked. Patrice Vilkis. My father's brother. Joanna's father.
Yes, I said.
He's my uncle. Joanna's my best friend.
Who's Joanna? His daughter?
I nodded.
Well, that's why you're deported, he said, rubbing the mittens together. Your mother knows, she just hasn't told you. So there you have it.
What do you mean that's why we're deported? How do you know? I asked.
What does it matter how I know? Your uncle escaped from Lithuania before you were deported.
You're lying.
Am I? Your aunt's maiden name was German, so your uncle's family escaped, probably repatriated through Germany. Your father helped them. He was part of it. So your family was then put on the list. So your father's in prison, you'll die here in Arctic hell, and your best friend is probably living it up in America by now.
What was he saying? Joanna escaped and went to America? How could that be possible?
Repatriate if they can get away with it, said my father, stopping abruptly when he saw me in the doorway.
Dear Lina, now that the Christmas holiday has passed, life seems on a more serious course. Father has boxed up most of his books, saying they take up too much space. I thought of my last birthday. Papa was late coming to the restaurant. I told him I had received nothing from Joanna. I noticed that he stiffened at the mention of my cousin.
She's probably just busy, he had said.
Sweden is preferable, said Mother.
It's not possible, said Papa. Germany is their only choice.
Who's going to Germany? I yelled from the dining room. Silence. I thought all of Auntie's family was in Germany, I said. Apparently, she has a relative in America. She gets letters from him. He's in Pennsylvania. It was possible. Joanna's freedom had cost me mine.
I'd give anything for a cigarette, said the bald man.
Chapter 74.
But why didn't you tell me?
We were trying to protect your uncle. They were going to help us, said Mother.
Help us what? Asked Jonas.
Escape, whispered Mother. There was no need to lower our voices. Everyone pretended to occupy themselves with their fingernails or clothing, but they could hear every word. Only Janina watched intently. She sat on her knees next to Jonas, swatting lice off her eyebrows. When they got to Germany, they were going to process papers for us to try to repatriate as well.
What's repatriate?
Asked Janina. To go back to where your family is originally from, I told her.
Are you German?
She asked Mother. No, dear, but my sister-in-law's family was born in Germany, said Mother. We thought we could get papers through them. And Papa helped them? So he was an accessory? I asked. Accessory? He committed no crime, Lina. He helped them. Their family, she said. So is Joanna in Germany? I asked. Most likely, said Mother. It all went horribly wrong. After they left, your father received reports in April that the NKVD had entered and searched their house. Someone must have informed the Soviets. Who would do such a thing? Asked Jonas. Lithuanians who work with the Soviets. They give information about other people in order to protect themselves. Someone hacked and coughed in the hut. I can't believe Joanna didn't tell me, I said. Joanna didn't know. Surely her parents didn't tell her. They feared she might tell someone. She thought they were going to visit a family friend, said Mother. Andris said they thought his father had international contacts. Now the Soviets think Papa has communication with someone outside Lithuania, said Jonas quietly. That means he's in danger. Mother nodded. Janina got up and lay down next to her mother. Thoughts swam through my brain. I couldn't process one before another stepped over it. We were being punished while Joanna's family lived comfortably in Germany. We had given up our lives for theirs. Mother was angry that the bald man had told me. She had trusted him with the secret. He had given it up for 5 minutes of mittens. Hadn't Mother and Papa thought to trust us? Did they consider the consequences before they helped them escape? I scratched the back of my head. Lice were biting a trail down the nape of my neck. How selfish! How could they do this to us? I said. They had to give up things too, said Jonas. My mouth fell open. What do you mean? I asked. They gave up nothing. We gave it all for them. They gave up their home. Uncle gave up his store. Joanna gave up her studies. Her studies. Joanna wanted to be a doctor as much as I wanted to be an artist. Although I could still draw, she could not pursue medicine with a war raging in Germany. Where was she? Did she know what had happened to us? Had the Soviets managed to keep the deportations a secret from the world? If so, how long would that last? I thought of the American supply ship sailing away. Would anyone think to look for us in the Siberian Arctic? If Stalin had his way, we'd be entombed in the ice and snow. I got my paper. I sat near the firelight of the stove. Anger sizzled within me. It was so unfair. But I couldn't hate Joanna. It wasn't her fault. Whose fault was it? I drew two hands clutching onto each other, yet pulling apart. I drew a swastika on her palm, and a hammer and sickle on top of my hand, the Lithuanian flag shredded and falling in between. I heard a scraping sound. The man who wound his watch carved a small piece of wood with his knife. The logs popped, spitting ashes out of the barrel. It looks scratched, said Jonas. He sat cross-legged on my bed, looking at one of the Munch prints I had received from Oslo. It is. He used his palette knife to scrape texture into the canvas, I said. It makes her look confused, said Jonas. If it weren't scratched, she would look sad. But the scratches make confusion. Exactly, I said, using long strokes to comb through my warm, clean hair. But to Munch, that made the painting feel alive. He was a confused man. He didn't care about proportion. He wanted it to feel real. Jonas flipped to the next print. Does this feel real to you? He said, his eyes wide. Definitely, I told him. That's called ashes. I don't know about real. Maybe real scary, said Jonas as he got up to leave. You know, Lena, I like your paintings better than these. These are too weird. Good night. Good night, I said. I took the papers and flopped down on my bed, sinking into my puffy goose down duvet. A comment in the margin from an art critic read, Munch is primarily a lyric poet in color. He feels colors but does not see them. Instead, he sees sorrow, crying, and withering. Sorrow, crying, and withering. I saw that in Ashes, too. I thought it was brilliant. Ashes. I had an idea. I grabbed a stick from next to the stove. I peeled back the outer skin to reveal the pulp. I separated the fibers, forming bristles. I grabbed a handful of snow from outside the door and carefully mixed in ashes from the barrel. The color was uneven, but made a nice gray watercolor. Chapter 75. November came. Mother's eyes lacked their wink and sparkle. We had to work harder for her to smile. It came only when her chin rested on the heel of her hand, or when Jonas mentioned Papa in our evening prayers. Then she would lift her face, the corners of her mouth turned up with hope. I worried for her. At night I closed my eyes and thought of Andrus. I saw his fingers raking through his disheveled brown hair, his nose tracing a line down my cheek the night before we left. I remembered his wide smile when he teased me in the ration line. I saw his tentative eyes handing me Dombian's son, and his reassurance as the truck pulled away. He said he'd find me. Did he know where they had taken us? That they laughed and wagered upon our deaths? Find me, I whispered. The man who wound his watch looked at the sky. He said a storm was coming. I believed him. Not because of the pale gray of the sky, but because of the bustle of the NKVD. They shouted at us, their devise pushed with an urgency. Even Ivanov was upon us. Normally he shouted orders from afar. Today he hastened to and from the barrack, coordinating every effort. Mrs. Rimmis tried to negotiate advance rations for the impending storm. Ivanov laughed. If there's a storm, you won't work. Why should you get a ration? But how will we survive without bread? Asked Mrs. Rimmis. I don't know. How will you? Said Ivanov. I pilfered wood from the NKVD barracks. There was no other way. We would need a lot for the storm. I went back for more. Snow began to fall. That's when I saw it. Mother stood, talking to Ivanov and Kretsky behind the NKVD barracks. What was she doing? I stepped out of sight and squinted to see. Ivanov spit on the ground. He then leaned close in to Mother's face. My heart began to pound. Suddenly, he lifted his gloved hand to his temple, mocking a gun firing. Mother flinched. Ivanov threw his head back and laughed. He walked into the NKVD barracks. Mother and Kretsky stood motionless, snow falling all around them. Kretsky reached out and put a hand on her shoulder. I saw his lips moving. Mother's knees buckled. He caught her by the waist. Her face contorted and fell against his chest. She pounded his shoulder with her fist. Mother! I screamed, running toward her. I tripped over the firewood, tumbling from under my coat. I grabbed her from Kretsky, pulling her to me. Mother! We fell to our knees. Kostas! She sobbed. I stroked her hair, hugging her to me. Kretsky's boots shifted. I looked up at him. Shot. In Krasnoyarsk prison, he said. The air crushed in around me, pushing my body deep into the snow. No! You're wrong! I said. My eyes searching Kretsky's. He's coming to get us. He's on his way. He's wrong, Mother. They think he's dead because he has left. He got my drawings. He's coming for us. No, Kretsky shook his head. I stared at him. No. Mother wept, her body chugging into mine. Papa. The word barely escaped my lips. Kretzky took a step closer, reaching to help Mother. Loathing purged from my mouth.
Get away from her! Stay away! I hate you! Do you hear me? I hate you!
Kretzky stared at Mother. Me too, he said. He walked away, leaving me on the ground with Mother. We sank deeper, snow blanketing us, the wind sharp against our faces like needles.
Come, Mother. A storm is coming.
Her legs couldn't carry her. Her chest heaved with every step, throwing us off balance. Snow whirled around us, limiting my sight.
Help me! I screamed. Somebody, please!
I heard nothing but the wail of the winds. Mother, match my steps. Walk with me. We must get back. There's a storm! Mother didn't walk. She just repeated my father's name into the falling snow.
Help!
Elena! It was Mrs. Rimmis.
Yes, we're here! Help us!
I cried. Two figures emerged through the wall of wind and snow. Lina?
Jonas, please!
My brother and Mrs. Rimmis came through the snow, their arms extended.
Oh, dear God, Elena!
Said Mrs. Rimmis. We dragged Mother into our yurta. She lay face down on a wood plank, Mrs. Rimmis at her side, Yanina peering over her.
Lina, what is it?
Said Jonas, terrified. I stared blankly.
Lina!
I turned to my brother.
Papa! Papa!
His face fell. I nodded slowly. I couldn't speak. A sound came out of my mouth, a twisted, pitiful moan. This wasn't happening. This couldn't be happening. Not Papa. I had sent the drawings. I saw Jonas's face rewind before me. He suddenly looked his age, vulnerable. Not like a young man fighting for his family, smoking books, but like the little schoolboy who ran into my bedroom the night we were taken. He looked at me. Then at Mother. He walked over to her, lay down, and carefully put his arms around her. Snow blew through a crack in the mud, falling on their hair. Yanina wrapped her arms around my legs. She hummed softly.
I'm sorry. So sorry, said the repeater.
Chapter 76. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't speak. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw Papa's face, battered, peering down from the bathroom hole on the train.
Courage, Lina,
he said to me. Exhaustion and grief inched heavily into every fiber of my body, yet I was wide awake. My mind flickered as if on short circuit, spitting never-ending images of anguish, anxiety, and sorrow at me. How did Kretzky know? There was a mistake. It was another man, not Papa. It was possible, right? I thought of Andrus, searching the train cars for his father. He thought it was possible, too. I wanted to tell Andrus what had happened. I put my hand in my pocket and clutched the stone. My drawings had failed. I had failed. I tried to sketch, but couldn't. When I started to draw, the pencil moved by itself, propelled by something hideous that lived inside of me. Papa's face contorted. His mouth pulled in agony. His eyes radiated fear. I drew myself screaming at Kretzky, my lips twisted. Three black snakes with fangs spurted out of my open mouth. I hid the drawings in Dombey's son. Papa was strong. He was a patriot. Did he fight? Or was he unaware? Did they leave him in the dirt like Ona? I wondered if Jonas had the same questions. We didn't discuss it. I wrote a letter to Andrus, but it became smudged with tears. The storm raged. The wind and icy snow created a deafening roar of white noise. We dug a path out the door to collect our rations. Two Finns lost in the blizzard couldn't find their yurta. They squeezed into ours. One had dysentery. The stench made me gag.
My scalp was crawling with lice. On the second day, Mother got up and insisted on shoveling the door. She looked drawn, like a part of her soul had escaped.
Mother, you should rest, said Jonas. I can dig through the snow.
It does no good to lie here, said Mother. There is work to be done. I must do my part. On the third day of the storm, the man who wound his watch directed the two Finns back to their yurta.
Take that bucket outside. Wash it out in the snow, the bald man told me.
Why me? I asked. We'll take turns, said Mother. We'll all have to do it. I took the bucket out into the darkness. The winds had retreated. Suddenly, I couldn't breathe. The moisture in my nostrils had frozen. This was only November. The polar night would last until the beginning of March. The weather would get worse. How could we withstand it? We had to make it through the first winter. I hurried with my bucket duty and returned to the yurta. I felt like Janina, whispering to Papa at night like she whispered to her dead doll. November 20, Andrus's birthday. I had counted the days carefully. I wished him a happy birthday when I woke and thought about him while hauling logs during the day. At night, I sat by the light of the stove reading Dombian Sun. Krasivaya. I still hadn't found the word. Maybe I'd find it if I jumped ahead. I flipped through some of the pages. A marking caught my eye. I leafed backward. Something was written in pencil in the margin on page 278.
Hello, Lina. You've gotten to page 278. That's pretty good.
I gasped, then pretended I was engrossed in the book. I looked at Andrus's handwriting. I ran my finger over his elongated letters in my name. Were there more? I knew I should read onward. I couldn't wait. I turned through the pages carefully, scanning the margins. Page 300.
Are you really on page 300, or are you skipping ahead now?
I had to stifle my laughter. Page 322.
Dombian Sun is boring. Admit it.
Page 364.
I'm thinking of you.
Page 412.
Are you maybe thinking of me?
I closed my eyes. Yes, I'm thinking of you. Happy birthday, Andrus. Chapter 77. It was mid-December. Winter had us in its jaws. The repeater had frostbite. The tips of his fingers were puckered, jet black. Gray, bulbous lumps appeared on the end of his nose. We wrapped ourselves in every piece of clothing and rags we could find. We tied our feet in old fishing nets that had washed ashore. Everyone bickered in the yurta, getting on each other's nerves. Small children began dying. Mother took